Welcome to the podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. Our podcast weaves together the message and a taste of the music that we experience each Sunday morning as we root our lives in grace through worship here at The Table. More and more people are finding their way to The Table through this podcast, so if you are one of the many, many folks who tune in each week from other parts of California, other parts of our country, or even from other places in the world, we would invite you to take a next step in growing in faith here at The Table. You can do that online at our website, thetableumc.org. There you'll find links to social media and also a way to make a deep commitment to our community to express how you hope to root your life in grace, to grow in faith, to reach in love, and to give generously. If you're one of the many people listening to this but haven't quite walked through the door of the sanctuary yet on a Sunday morning, we would love to welcome you into the beauty of this sanctuary. We gather each Sunday for worship at 9:30 and at 11. Our address is 5265 H Street in East Sacramento.
Kanisa litajengwe na mimi na wewe. Kanisa litajengwe na mimi na wewe. Iyo yo yo yo. Iyo yo yo yo. Iyo yo yo yo. Iyo yo yo yo. Iyo.
We are continuing to move in the book of Ruth during this worship series. There are folks here who have been part of communities of faith for many, many decades, and a lot of our churches follow something that's called the lectionary. It's a prescribed set of readings that the global church all reads together, and what you're about to hear is never included in those readings. And so what they do is they'll take like two lines from chapter 3 and then they like cut everything else out. So no matter how many times you've been in worship all these years, it's very likely that you've never witnessed this. So let's watch together Ruth 3.
In chapter 1, we learn about where Ruth came from. A man named Elimelech marries a woman named Naomi in the town of Bethlehem. They have two sons, and they all travel to Moab during a famine. Elimelech dies, and the two sons marry women from Moab. One marries Orpah, the other marries Ruth. Those two men die in Moab, and Naomi decides to return to Bethlehem. Orpah returns to her family, but Ruth travels with Naomi back to Bethlehem. In Bethlehem, Ruth gleans in the fields of a man named Boaz. He is a righteous man who sees her and gives her additional food and water, telling her to only work in his fields so that she can be safe and well taken care of. Ruth goes home, tells Naomi of what happened, and Naomi agrees that she should stay in those fields because Boaz is actually a close relative of theirs. So Ruth gleans in the fields belonging to Boaz until the end of the harvest. Chapter 3 begins with Naomi and Ruth discussing whether Ruth should get married again. Naomi points out that Boaz is single and that there is an opportunity for Ruth to talk to him that very night. Naomi says, "He'll be working on the threshing floor tonight. Get dressed nice and go to him. Wait until he's done working, has had his meal, and has lied down. Then go, uncover his feet, and lie down at his feet, and he will then tell you what to do." Ruth goes to the threshing floor and does as Naomi told her. She waits for Boaz to finish working and having his meal until he is lying down to sleep. Ruth goes over, uncovers his feet, and lies there. Around midnight, Boaz woke up, startled, and asks, "Who are you?" Ruth answers, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." Ruth was asking Boaz to marry her and rescue her family. Boaz responds, "May the Lord bless you for your kindness. You did not go after the young men, rich or poor, but instead chose me. I will do as you ask, for the entire town knows that you are worthy. However, the law says that there is one more person between you and I that should redeem your family. If he does, that is a good thing. If he isn't willing, then I will surely redeem you." So she slept there until morning, but arose before the morning light so that people did not see where she came from. Before she left, Boaz gave 6 measures of barley for Ruth and her mother-in-law. When Ruth had returned, Naomi asks how it went. Ruth shows the barley and tells her what had happened, and Naomi says, "Be patient, my daughter. We will see what happens soon enough, for he will not rest until the matter is settled today." Therefore, Ruth and Naomi wait to see if Boaz will marry Ruth and redeem their family.
Love is a hunger, a famine in your soul. I thought I planted beauty, but it never grows. Now I'm on my hands and knees, trying to gather up my dreams, trying to hold on to anything. And we can shake a fist in times like this, when we don't understand, or we just hold hands.
You and me, me and you, where you go, I'll go too. I'm with you. Your heart finds a home. I won't let you feel alone.
I'm with you.
I'm with you.
I'm really grateful that Matt shared that word with you about the lectionary, because it's true. I'm really grateful that we are willing to look at a part of the Bible that pretty much, even if you are new to church, I just don't imagine you will have heard this. And if you've been in church, a person who has attended faithfully, you also wouldn't have heard it. So it kind of levels the playing field for most of us. And it's this third chapter of Ruth. And it's really a miracle in any way that we have the book of Ruth. I think it's common knowledge that men most likely are the ones who wrote down what we have that we call the Bible. Men were those original scribes. So the fact that men wrote this down in it of itself is nothing short of a miracle. It was really fun to hear Joey preach last week, which he hadn't done before, and he said, "Whoa, dude, women have a book in the Bible? Things change." No. What I really want to say is, women, we are here to stay. We're not going anywhere. In Ruth, we read the story of two women, an aged Naomi, who is the mother-in-law to a young Ruth. And we get the inside scoop on how they both struggled to survive in the midst of a deeply patriarchal culture. And these women, I just think they're amazing. They bear their own burdens. They are acquainted with grief. They're both widows. They are acquainted with danger, insecurity at every level of their life. They are unlikely companions who forge a deep bond as they uncover their future. See, Ruth shapes her own identity and destiny and makes really radical choices that defy customs and proprieties, maybe even conventions, what people expect of her to do in her time. There's a biblical scholar named Phyllis Tribble, and she reminds us that in the book of Ruth, one female has chosen another female in a world where life depends on men. There's no more radical decision, she says, in all the memories of Israel, meaning the people of God, the people of Israel. And the message is clear here. Women, not just men, were keepers of the covenant. While God seems very much unseen in Ruth, because God is not specifically referred to hardly at all, that does not mean that God is absent. A part of any community's strength is uncovering the realization that God is at work in the simplest, in the earthiest, and the most authentic of human experiences. That's why we sing Jikalele. That word means God is everywhere. We sing now, who will build the church? We will all build it together. God is in the midst of all of that realization. And it seems to me that finding the intersection of our stories with God's story, well, that's where all of truths begin. So just to recap a little, there are four scenes, which are the four chapters, that move us through the story of Ruth, and they're organized into those chapters, which we've been showing you each week by video. That's a little different for us, but we're doing it to help us keep track of the details and all of the characters, because there are some stories like this one that's just better, and if you're like me, visually seeing it really, really helps. We're also using a resource by Diane Levy Jacobson and her husband, David Vasquez Levy, of the Book of Ruth. And that's undergirding our work these 4 weeks. Matt shared the first scene a few weeks ago with an examination of the push and pull of migration and the sense of loss that's present for both Ruth and Naomi as they negotiate life as widows. And the second scene focuses more on as Joey called her, Naomi, our homie. I thought that was great. Along with Ruth and the many boundaries that those two women cross as they attempt to be resettled in a new land and culture and meet a distant relative named Boaz. We heard a little bit about him. The scene for this week that we are saying is usually not lifted up in churches takes us into the deep risks that Ruth and Naomi choose to take in order to survive. And just to remind us, before returning to Bethlehem, Naomi, that's where she's from, has expressed concern for Ruth, who's a Moabite woman, for Ruth's economic security, and probably her security at all. As Matt said, it would be like an American choosing to go to Iraq and settle there with a refugee as their mother-in-law, okay? So she's worried for her daughter-in-law because underneath Naomi's worry is the Levirate custom of the day. And that is that she has to attach herself to a man. And Naomi can no longer bear children. So there was no way she could provide additional sons for her daughter-in-law. And that custom is this that she was trying to talk about. A childless widow's brother-in-law has to marry her, okay? And the first son of this union is going to become the deceased man's heir. That's how you keep the name going. And so far in this story, this custom has just been put aside. It's not that they don't know it. It's that they have a more pressing concern. What are we going to eat? What will we eat and how are we going to survive in this patriarchal economy as two childless widows, one a foreigner? And when they arrive in Bethlehem, they meet, as it says, this man named Boaz. And he's described as a man of standing. Okay? So by all accounts, he was rich. And Joey reminded us last week that white people would consider him, he had done well for himself. But he was rich. And he uses his abilities and social status to influence the life of both Ruth and Naomi. And Matt clarified from the beginning that Moabites and the Israelites, as I said, they were always at odds. They did not get along. So Boaz allowing Ruth to glean his field where she is on her feet, that's what gleaning looks like, from early in the morning until the end of the day without resting ever for any moment, was a kindness. And I think it just simply means she was on her feet all day long, okay? Boaz, at the same time that he allows her to glean his field, and gleaning, let's remember, all the good produce, fruit, grain has been taken, and it's the leftovers. So we allow the poor people to come in and pick up the leftovers. That's what he's allowing for her. So it might have been enough food for a day, maybe 2 days. As he is kind to her, he also clearly instructs the men who are working in his fields not to touch. That's in verse 9, second chapter. Don't touch her. Don't humiliate or restrain her. That's in verses 15 and 16. For this work of gathering, gleaning as much as she can. So see, Boaz is a local guy, and he's using his financial and social position to go against the cultural norms to support Ruth, an immigrant, during her transition into this, her new land, God's land. And essentially what I want you to hear is he's protecting her from being sexually harassed as she is trying to do her best bending over in a field all day long on her feet. We like to think of ourselves as so advanced, don't we? You have to have your head in the sand if we think that the issues of sex and power are not just as prevalent today, unfortunately. Whether it's President 42 with an intern and a cigar, 45 confessing his exploits when he doesn't know that his microphone is on, or an actor who just plays a president, right? Decades ago, allegedly acting, what, presidential? Maybe he's just trying out to be a senator. Who knows? Sexual harassment in the workplace is as old as the biblical narrative. We hear it today. Maybe that's why they take it out of the lectionary. And we're uncovering it more, unfortunately, aren't we, every day? And I feel like it's okay to raise this in our community, given the commitment so many of us have expressed out loud towards diversity and inclusion in our community. Last week, I was really caught off guard when a number of women in our community, and I found out this morning a number of men too, but none of them said anything, noticed and expressed dismay to me that those three seats over there were occupied by Chris, our intern, Joey, our guest preacher, and Matt. Three men. Up front total, the count was one female, eight males. One person said, couldn't we have found four chairs, Linda? One woman asked or said, it felt like testosterone had run amok. Matt looked up amok. That's kind of interesting. Still another was very concerned that a first-time visitor would come in and see only one female up front. What would they think about our church? One of my favorites, though, was one who knows me really well, was listening to another. I'm not using names, so you guys can't track this. Said, well, we talked about it at dinner. And my husband said maybe Linda was in the kitchen. And then the woman who knows me is like, no, Linda's not in the kitchen. Because I wouldn't know what to do there. But seriously, it's really, we want you to know our choice was intentional for me to sit here. We talked about it. Because from our point of view, it also feels important from time to time for us to get to see and be in worship from, see it from your vantage point. But we are also clear that uncovering our own unconscious bias is a constant discipline, not just for us, but for all of us. So we are grateful, really, to everyone for watching over us, because sexism is real, and we are grateful for this strong community, right? Unfortunately, Naomi and Ruth were not so sure of the strength of their community. And they had to proceed strategically and really carefully as Ruth uncovered loyalties and negotiated ways to stand on her own two feet little by little. So I'm going to move on, and this is where I want you to get ready. It goes into PG-13. Some would say it goes into rated R, and the people who wrote the resource said this is an X rating. So I'm doing my best. Stay with me. So in the Bible, the word Gala, G-A-L-A, means to uncover. And that word in Hebrew dominates all of the opening part of this chapter 3. Why? Why does it do that? Because like in chapter 1, Matt told us, these seemingly deliberate uses of wordplay, ambiguity, and double entendre create a fairly dramatic tension that holds all the way through the book and actually never really resolve. So this week we get two other words, lie down and know, K-N-O-W, that kind of know. And they are woven throughout. Uncover, lie down, know. The writer's penchant for puns develops into a very mischievous use of words and phrases that may be understood to have either innocent or may be understood as having sexually suggestive meanings. Believe me, we had a lot of fun with this in my kitchen table this week. See, Ruth has this successful meeting with Boaz in the field and shares this success back home with Naomi. Though Boaz and Ruth appear to respect each other, and perhaps we can assume reading that there might be a growing attraction between the two of them, it seems like he's available for marriage. That would have been part of what they're looking for. There's been like 2 months of daily contact in the field where she's gleaning, and nothing has happened. No spark has been fanned into a flame between them. So Naomi initiates a plan to work out their own destinies. Naomi tells Ruth to go take a shower, bathe, put on some perfume, start to sound familiar, and your best clothes. Get dressed up. Then Naomi instructs Ruth to go find Boaz at his threshing floor. So why is that important? This is a rendering of an ancient threshing floor. The threshing floor is the place, you can see it in the middle, where they're separating the wheat from the chaff as they work with grain. And it's the place where all the men of the village gather doing that work, and they stay the night around the edges of this to guard their own grain. And scholars agree that they're hanging out at night after a day's work and the men are partying. So the women who would come to the edge of the threshing floor when the men are partying are of questionable character, means prostitute. That's what that means. What do you imagine might be a threshing floor of today? Just think about our own world. What scenes do you imagine happen at our own threshing floors? Naomi tells Ruth, when Boaz lies down on the threshing floor, note where he is lying. And, very important, she tells her to do this not at noon, not at 4, midnight, right? What sorts of activities happen lying down in the middle of the night? Next, Naomi gives this instruction. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He's going to tell you what to do. Ruth tells Naomi, I'll do whatever you say. So now we have uncover, lie down, know, K-N-O-W, and a new word, feet. Feet? Uncover his feet? Really? Really? I guess that could be true. I recently learned that some people really do actually love feet. I mean, who knew? Let's watch. Some people really love real feet. And I think Idris does mean feet. But most scholars agree the word feet, as used here and in most all of Hebrew scripture, is actually a euphemism for, you know, foot. One foot. Right? So this really shocked some people in my kitchen table. We're all women. And one person said, "No, really?" And I'm like, "Yes, really." And she says, "Really? You mean like flower?" I'm like, yeah, I guess if you use that word. We used euphemisms, right? Feet and flower for genitals. I'm not making this up. You can look it up. Back to the story. Why does Naomi send Ruth to the threshing floor to uncover Boaz's feet? See, by coming at midnight, now that you know all of this, you understand Ruth is taking an enormous risk. She's acting in ways that on the surface are quite inappropriate. In that song that we heard, it says, "I'm on my hands and knees trying to survive." Remember that Levirate law? Everything hinges for her survival on the historic responsibility of whoever is identified as the next of kin. And Naomi discovered at the end of chapter 2 that this man, Boaz, who treats Ruth with such kindness, was maybe one of their next of kin. And it's noteworthy that one of the jobs of the next of kin is to provide a child for the dead relative so that his name doesn't disappear in the line. And this is the system of the Levirate marriage law that Naomi in the beginning was so sure couldn't be in effect, but now seems maybe to think is possible through Boaz. But Boaz goes off script, right? He does not give her any instructions. Shocking. Instead, he says, "Who are you?" Does he really maybe not believe that he is the next of kin? Well, he doesn't do what Ruth is expecting, but that doesn't stop her. She improvises. She's direct. She identifies herself and does not wait for his initiative. She takes her own initiative. She knows exactly what to do. And she tells him, "Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." That really holds two things. The word kanap is translated as wing or cloak. Okay, spread your cloak of protection. So she's asking for the Levirate marriage law to protect her, sort of. Because in tradition, if a man was saying that, "I will spread my cloak over you," that's what it meant. But if a female uses that word in Hebrew, it would have been taken with sexual overtones. So she's even risking him being offended that she would be so bold as to ask for that. So is she asking him to marry her? Or is she asking him for sex? Or is she asking for both? It can be argued that Boaz's words, those words in verses 10 through 13, provide us the necessary clues to conclude that actually she is asking for two things. One is for marriage. And he says, "I'll do what you ask." And the second is for him to actually be her next of kin, which is where the sex comes in, to provide with a baby, see? And it depends on things that are actually out of his control. Matt will talk about that next week. But he accepts this, sees Ruth not as a foreign prostitute, all dressed and gussied up, right? Lying at his feet. But rather he treats her as a member of his family for whom he has deep, abiding responsibility. In this case, Boaz is definitely reading the spirit of the Levirate law rather than the letter because no one would have expected that of him. Boaz gives Ruth also, at that point, 6 measures of barley. See, she's been gleaning, remember? She has to come every day, but he hands her 6. This may be interpreted as a pre-marriage price. That's what scholars say. Like he's going to move forward. Or money. There's also that. For services rendered. And what I really need us to hold, what I want us to hold is, we're reading it because we know the end of the story. Some of us do, some of us don't. But at that moment, she didn't know what that 6 levels of barley was for. She had no idea what he may or may not do. She was very, very deeply vulnerable. And then he tells her, go back under cover of light, like he doesn't want her to be humiliated so that people won't see her coming back from the threshing floor. So it's up for you to decide, really, what was all of that about. One Old Testament scholar, Walter Brueggemann, wrote it this way. When read in this way, it is possible to see that Ruth is a daring model of a woman who acts decisively to create a future for herself in a patriarchal social context where no good future was an offer for her. On my reading, Ruth demonstrates a fierce solidarity with her mother-in-law. And she clearly demonstrates a strong agency in the narrative by telling Boaz what she wants, pushing him to drop his veneer of social acceptability that everyone else would have supported him to do by her verbal sparring in which she employs herself. So many subtle yet, I hope now, recognizable double entendres. However you want to hear this, I believe the book of Ruth is a subtle and artistic presentation of the ways in which human courage and divine mystery, hiddenness, allow Israel, God's people, us, to imagine futures beyond any patriarchal or ethnocentric cultural norms. In Ruth, it is human action that is of primary importance. It is human beings who resist and challenge the social systems that so tightly dictate such action, but which are never entirely free, you know, from ideological gaps from time to time. The hope realized then is that God will in turn respond to all of our human initiative and bring to fruition what human beings are working towards. I want you to try and think about it like this. Think for a minute of Rosa Parks. She was alive precisely at the time when our country was deep in a cultural battle for equality of African American citizens, right? Everyone pretty much, I think, knows that. And Rosa Parks acted decisively to create a future for herself. What I think sometimes gets lost in that is she did it in a patriarchal social context. She wasn't in charge. Dr. King and his cohorts were in charge, and she got tired and sat down on the bus, and they got angry with her because she didn't do it at the right time when they had prescribed it. She said, "I'm tired." She did it when there was no good future for her. And she what? She changed history. See, the hope is that God will in turn respond to initiatives like that and bring to fruition, as I said, what we are all trying to work towards. To the extent that the book of Ruth has a theology at all, it's one that is less traditional, but also it's not simplistic, as is so often put out there. It's a theology that refuses to see the human characters in the drama as God's puppets. You know, this God as a puppeteer who has everything worked out. And that because of this refusal to see it this way in the book of Ruth may ultimately prove more relevant to the modern world than I think people have given it a chance to prove. Because we take it out of the lectionary even. See, I believe the key is to understand the vulnerability and ultimately the deep courage and conviction that it takes for a person, any person, to stand up to conventions and deny cultural norms when we are confronted with the circumstances in front of us. And one may not feel that the circumstances are extraordinary at the time. But history ends up telling a different story. I want to just say a few names, and you fill in the details in your own mind. Sacagawea. Harriet Beecher Stowe. Margaret Sanger. Rosa Parks. Colin Kaepernick. Where does risk really take us? Scholar Phyllis Trible allows for a God at work in and through the lives of all the women in Scripture, those of us who are named and most of us who are unnamed. And as a whole, she writes about Ruth. This human comedy of Ruth suggests a theological interpretation of feminism, women working out our own salvation with fear and trembling, sometimes on our hands and knees. For it is God who is working in the women. Naomi works as a bridge between tradition and innovation, and as the mother-in-law. And then Ruth and the females of Bethlehem work as paradigms for radicality. And all together, they are women in culture, women against culture, and women transforming culture, all at the same time. What they reflect, what they do is challenge all of that. And that challenges the legacy of faith to this day for all who have ears to hear the story of the women in a man's world. And in this frame, Boaz may ultimately be seen as an ally. He chooses to ally himself with these women and use his privilege to take his own risks to defy culture as well. So will we, as a human family, allow the benefits of this kind of risk to benefit our own communities today? It's my hope that we may find God in this story, in this rich human tapestry that is being uncovered in every corner of this story, and maybe especially the one that's been hidden from us. And that God may be unseen, as in directly referred to in Scripture, but God is in no way absent, because God is in the push and pull of migration and the crossing of the boundaries into new ways and in the gift of inventive and tenacious human beings who make surprising discoveries as they uncover things, as they uncover little by little all of the challenges that life sends their way. May we find ourselves, each other, in this story. Amen.
Where you lead, I will follow. Anywhere that you tell me to, if you need, you need. Where you lead.